You are listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Christopher J. Yates' new novel, Gristmill Road, begins with three teenagers in the woods and an act of brutal violence. Matthew ties up and shoots Hannah with a BB gun as Patrick stands by and watches. The novel then moves forward more than a quarter of a century, where it finds that although all three have been haunted by the incident, they've lived with different ideas about what exactly happened and why. Which of them has been the most damaged by it, and which is the most responsible, is a story that unfolds and changes throughout the novel. Publishers Weekly calls it an edgy, intelligent thriller that explores the aftermath of a senseless crime. Gristmill Road is published by Picador, and I'm pleased and happy that it brings Christopher Yates to the show today. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Jonathan.
So I sort of gave a really brief thumbnail of the overarching story, but are the facts in the story, the facts of the incident, are they in doubt? And how do the different perspectives change the truth of what happened?
They are very much in doubt, yes. So you actually... the three people you mentioned who are in that clearing when the shooting incident happens, you hear from each of them throughout the book, and each one of them has a different perspective on what happened, and each one of them has some different information to give you, so that eventually by the time you've heard from all of them, you find out what really happened, the mm-hmm. truth behind a seemingly senseless act of violence.
And I talked about Matthew is the one who ties Hannah, the victim, to the tree. Patrick is the one who is standing by and watching. And the novel moves back and forth in time from the period around the incident, 1982, to more than 25 years later, when these characters are approaching 40.
Yes.
Why did you choose for them to tell the story from that particular vantage point?
I liked setting it in 2008, so the character of Patrick loses his job. You know, it was the time of the great global economic upheaval. Mm-hmm. He works in finance, and he loses his job and spends most of his time as a food blogger. So I really liked that era as being something that could anchor the story of them in adulthood moving forward.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting is that the incident happens when they are adolescents, and you're writing about it from their perspective of being someone in their 40s, another time filled with angst because it's the beginning of middle age. And in those two eras, you are trying to figure yourself out. Was that part of in your mind as you were coming up with this story?
Absolutely it was. So yes, I mean, everyone knows that teenagerhood is a very difficult time.
Fraught, I
believe. Fraught's a good word. And Patrick especially is having a very hard time heading into middle age. He's lost his job. He's arguably a depressive. And it's a very difficult time for him. So when everything comes to a head and Matthew comes back into their lives, you know, it's going to be very difficult for him because he's haunted by the guilt of standing by and doing nothing. And now this character comes back into their lives and, you know, things are not going to end well.
Mm-hmm. Now, why did you start the story from the perspective of Patrick, the onlooker?
I started with Patrick. I mean, probably the real reason I started there is it's very close to my own experience. Not the shooting incident, but there's a scene recounted in the first chapter where Matthew throws a spear at Patrick, and Patrick responds to this by taking the spear out of his leg and returning the spear to Matthew like some kind of bird dog. Hmm. Now, that was something that actually happened to me. My neighbor did this to me. So this was really the nugget that began the story. I thought, if I fictionalize this, what would Patrick be like and what would Matthew be like? And after this spear-throwing incident, how about I pile on another terrible crime and then we'll go from there?
You know, a couple of times in talking about Patrick, you say, and then Matthew coming back into their lives.
Yes.
And you say their lives, yes, because the book starts with this incident in 82. Fast forward, they're now 40, and the there in that, excuse me, is Patrick and Hannah.
Yes. So we find out fairly quickly that Patrick and Hannah are married, even though Patrick is haunted by what happened. It might sound very unlikely, but I promise you there's a reason in the novel why they end up married, but that's probably something it's best to let the reader discover for themselves.
I'm glad you said that, because I do have a tendency to give all sorts of spoilers. Why Patrick is known in the book by a number of nicknames. Who calls him Patchy? Or I'm sorry, who calls him Patch, and why?
So his wife calls him Patch. He's known as a child as Patch or Paddy Boy by his father, and Matthew calls him Tricky. And that's a little nod to the fact that there's perhaps something. He seems like a very straightforward, gullible guy, but Matthew sees something in him that causes him to call him Tricky. And I think throughout the novel, you discover that, you know, there's a lot more to Patch than just the quiet onlooker.
And Patrick hates that nickname. And
yes.
Is that because he, in some way, recognizes himself in that nickname?
I think it brings up bad memories as well. You know, Matthew was the only one who ever called him Tricky, and I think it brings up the memory to Patrick that he stood by and did nothing while a crime was committed.
Uh-huh. Matthew and Patrick are very different in terms of their backgrounds. Can you describe the difference between the two?
Yes. So Patrick's father is a lawyer, and also a politician. He's just beginning his political campaign when Patrick is young. And then later in the book, we find out that he's done quite well in politics. Whereas Matthew comes from a very poor family. They live upstate in something little more than a trailer, junk piled around the house. Very poor upbringing with an abusive father. So, yeah, they're at either end of the spectrum, really.
And am I right to think of Patrick as a kid who's young for his age, a late developer, excuse me, and Matthew as one who's naturally older? Or am I thinking of that because I'm looking at Matthew through Patrick's eyes?
No, you're 100% right. And that's why I found it an interesting age to write about, the age of 13. I mean, I had this experience myself where there are some very young 13-year-olds and there are some very old, even sexually experienced 13-year-olds. I was definitely the young 13-year-old.
You're listening to Christopher Yates talking about his new novel, Gristmill Road. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. How does Matthew come to Patrick? How do they end up becoming friends?
They actually become friends because Matthew helps Patrick out when the school bully calls him out for a fight behind the bleachers. Patrick is terrified, is undoubtedly going to get beaten to a pulp by the school bully. But just as this is about to happen, Matthew steps in and protects him.
And this solidified the bond. Did they know each other at all before that? Or just Matthew just saw this happening and stepped forward to come to his aid?
So before that, Matthew was actually the new kid in school. Originally, he grows up in Queens, and then he moves upstate. And it's very early in his first term at school. He wants to be friends with Patrick, but no one really wants to be friends with Matthew. So when he steps in and helps him out, this is where their friendship stems from.
This is very interesting, the parallel here. Matthew is not an onlooker in that incident with Patrick. And yet when Matthew was doing what he did to Hannah, Patrick held back.
Absolutely. And I think we'd all like to think that if we found ourselves in a terrible situation, we would all step in. I just don't know if that's true.
Does Matthew envy Patrick?
He envies his upbringing, the fact that he comes from a family that loves him, a family that has some money. And as I said, Matthew's own father is abusive.
And out of work a lot.
Out of work a lot, drinks a lot, and abuses Matthew, yes. Yeah. I think he's jealous of a stable family life and a stable father figure.
Now, do you want the reader to start out thinking that Patrick's memory of the incident is the most accurate of the three because he was an onlooker and not a participant, and also because the book starts out with the incident being played out from Patrick's perspective.
Absolutely. And as the reader, hopefully you think that's perhaps all there is to this incident. I mean, it on the face of it, it would seem that Matthew's a psychopath and Patrick's an onlooker and Hannah's a victim. But actually, the more you find out everything from all of their points of view, you realize there's a lot more to the story than that. And 26 years later, when they come together, I mean, the truth comes out about what really happened, what really led to the shooting incident.
So really, is this book about truth and memory?
Yes, absolutely. Matthew has a line in there where he talks about truth. Most people think of truth as a lens, but actually Matthew thinks of it as a kaleidoscope. Mm-hmm. You know, there are different angles to truth. There are different aspects to truth. And I would say everyone has their own truth. And, you know, what happens when these different truths collide?
Is it possible to settle on a single version of something that's the truth?
I'm not sure it is. I mean, perhaps factually we can settle on a truth. I'm not sure if we talk about people's conflicting emotions, if we can settle on a truth.
Why do you think Patrick, again, he's the onlooker, why do you think he's been so affected by the incident, by the crime?
Well, the first big thing is his guilt. You know, he feels terrible that he did nothing. And he feels, and he's now married to the victim. So he's reminded of his guilt every single day when he wakes up to his wife who has nightmares, who wakes up in the middle of the night screaming. I think he just feels terribly, terribly guilty. And he wants to make up for this. And unfortunately, in wanting to make up for this, this is what will lead to some devastating results later on.
And sort of makes you wonder, for the listeners probably thinking, well, why did he marry her if he's racked with such guilt? Christopher, do you think, is it a worse crime, you think, to stand by and not act than to be carried away by a fury and commit the crime?
That's an excellent question. You know, crimes of omission, they certainly exist legally in some countries. Doing nothing is considered a crime in some situations. But I think I have to come down on the side of saying that actually being the actor is the worst thing.
For those who don't know you, you writing novels, this is your second novel.
Yes.
But your previous full-time job was as a puzzle editor.
I was, indeed.
In London.
Yes.
Puzzles?
Puzzles, yes. Well, I trained as a lawyer and I gave up a career in law. And I think, you know, everyone who gives up a career in law goes into puzzles, don't they?
Yeah.
Of one sort or another.
It's just
a natural thing to do.
Right. I haven't been to London in a very long time, so I've never seen a London puzzle. But I know the English call their puzzles, it's called a cryptic. And they're really, really hard, I hear.
They are incredibly tough.
I mean,
yes.
Folks in England take them very, very seriously.
Take them very seriously. There's even a competition run by the London Times to find the best puzzler of the cryptic crosswords.
And so then you're a lawyer who leaves the law, goes into puzzles and becomes,
yes,
a puzzle editor, and then you leave that to become a novelist? Is there a natural progression from puzzle editor to novelist?
I think there is. I mean, for a start, there's words. I mean, we're talking about a love of words here. Crossword puzzles are often to do with a love of words, and writing is to do with a love of words. But also, I think when I write a novel, I'm almost setting myself a puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, the terrible incident that happened at the beginning of this novel, I had no idea why it happened. For 2 years, I had no idea why the boy Matthew tied the girl Hannah to the tree. I was getting slightly worried because, you know, I needed to explain this. And then after 2 years, it just came to me in a flash. And it was almost like I'd set myself my own puzzle. And finally, I solved it.
I'm wondering, have you ever structured a scene or even a sentence in either of your novels just around a word? Since you have this love of words.
That's a really good question. Off the top of my head, I can't think of a specific sentence. Well, you know, actually, so one interesting thing is I've become very interested in American words as opposed to English words. If there are any stable geniuses out there in the audience, they may be able to hear I'm not originally from America. So there are some American words that fascinate me, and one of those is blacktop. I'd never heard the word blacktop. In Britain, it's often called asphalt, which isn't a terribly attractive word.
We use that here too. Okay. But I mean, yeah. You know, it's interchangeable.
But we don't have the word blacktop at all in Britain, and there are a number of American portmanteau words I just think I enjoy. Sidewalk as well. We call it pavement in Britain. I don't know. There is something that appeals to me. And writing this novel in American was kind of difficult, but also really exciting to me because I got to explore the American language.
You've been listening to Christopher Yates about his new novel, Gristmill Road. Christopher, you're going to love Ben Zimmer, the Wall Street Journal's language columnist. We're going to be talking all about words tonight at 7:30. You can catch Christopher at Books Are Magic in conversation with Susanna Callahan. That's at 225 Smith Street in Brooklyn. Christopher, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Up next, Ben Zimmer, Wall Street Journal language columnist, talks to us about 2017's Words of the Year. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back.